Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, Two Managed Vets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of The Bend. Now, today I have a really special guest, Dr. Nicole Bruno, and I met Dr. Bruno at VMX when I attended one of her classes and was so impressed with her, I said, I've got to get you on the show. So after she gave me a card for a vegan restaurant by mistake, we got the real card, and now she is here with us today. So, Nicole, thank you very much for giving me your real card and taking the time to be with us today.
I'm just happy that we are in a modern day era where you could have found me through other ways besides having to reconnect with me again. But that is a funny story and one that I will always remember. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And the funny part is she says, "And I'm not even a vegan."
It was a really good restaurant. That's why I kept it.
It's just good food. So I love to ask all my guests, you know, the origin story. How did you get into vet med, and you know, what possessed you to do this as your profession?
Well, I grew up in New York City. I'm from Queens, New York, and I decided at the age of 12 that I wanted to be a veterinarian. A lot of it stemmed from like wanting to be a doctor. I always liked to take care of things. My older cousin was going to be a pediatrician, but I didn't think children were my way. I grew up in an apartment in New York City, and we would wait outside sometimes for a spot, a parking spot. And during that time, there would be a lot of stray animals walking. And, you know, the winters of New York, it would make me sad that they didn't have shelter. I would cry, and I would ask my mom if we could take them in. And my mom was like, "We can't have pets in our apartment building." And so that really bothered me. I would go to the bodega or the corner store and buy dog food or cat food. And I would have a little parade of animals following us from when we parked our car to basically the back door of our building. And it just bothered me all the time. And so I decided to take that love of wanting to take care of something, and then I loved animals, and I put that together and I said, I'm going to be a vet. My younger sister is 6 years younger, and eventually she said, "I want to be a vet too." And so it became this like family affair where I was always leading the effort. You know, I was ahead of the game. And so I always had an appreciation of mentorship because I did not see myself in this profession. And I knew that my sister was going to have the same experience. So I tried to do everything I could to support her in it. But, you know, it was really going to Tuskegee and seeing myself in the profession that really kind of solidified the deal that this was for me. Because earlier in my life, during my junior high school age years, I did not have that continuous representation and mentorship in this profession. So those were the things that stuck with me. But really going to Tuskegee ultimately kind of sealed that deal of saying, yes, you can be in this profession. There are people that want to do this with you, and you've got this. So I stayed on course, and here I am 17 years later as a vet.
Oh, well, you don't look like you could have been out of school 17 years. You look like you could have just got out.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. But I certainly feel that way.
So tell us about a couple of your life's curveballs, because you've had some challenges.
I did. And I've had challenges that were, you know, in each instance, different for me. One, I had a curveball in college where I actually, and that was a defining moment for me at Tuskegee as well, because I got into a really bad car accident driving, and I went off the road, fell into a ditch, and I ended up rupturing my spleen and having a fractured pelvis, fractured ribs. I needed a blood transfusion. I mean, I really, really messed myself up. And, you know, when you're 19 years old, First of all, I didn't know what I didn't know. Like, I didn't know even know what a spleen was or what it was doing. Like, all biology went out the window. So I was like, can I live without that? But the other part of it was I was always a very focused student. I knew I wanted to be a vet. I knew what I needed to get done to get to that goal. And that accident was a huge curveball. It set me back. It wasn't something that was planned, obviously, but you know, the extent of it and recovering from it was hard for me as a person that likes to check the boxes. So, you know, I had to learn very quickly that sometimes a delay doesn't always mean a denial in life, you know, and I think that there were times recovering that really I needed that time. I wasn't ready for certain things. So I'm glad I had that moment. And obviously I'm healed and great. But I think the one that really changed my life was something that affected everyone was the pandemic, you know? And for me, I was turning 40 that year. And so I think going into the year before COVID, I had all these expectations of what I wanted to do as a 40-year-old and accomplish. And one of them was to get back into DEI work. And early on, I said, this is something that I think I should be doing. And I want to figure out how I can practice and do it at the same time. And then we had the pandemic and that changed so much, especially when you're juggling multiple roles, like being a veterinarian, being a veterinary leader, being a mom, being and then all of the other roles you play, it really shifted how I could process just the grief that was also associated with COVID. And then right when I was navigating, getting over my grandmother's passing, the social unrest in the country kind of pushed us all of, into another angle. And for me, I just couldn't stay quiet anymore about the things that I had kind of suppressed in this career. And I wanted to speak up more. And that was the beginning of DEI really taking over and my pivot out of practice into doing this full time.
Yeah, I think the pandemic, we were talking about it right before we started the show, is it really was a time for us to sit back and reset. And then the things that were happening, I can remember particularly talking to a friend of mine when George Floyd was murdered, that it was you couldn't avoid it. You couldn't ignore it anymore. It was right there. And I remember talking to Bridget because Bridget is a Black woman and she actually is the publisher of my book. And I said, you know, I can't have your lived experience, but as a woman who travels alone a lot all over the country, I understand the constant nagging fear that somebody is going to, you know, attack you in some way, shape or form, just walking down the street. And I said, so, and she said, amplify it, you know, by 10, because she told me a story about being pulled over. She and her husband, and she's driving a Mercedes. She's, you know, just, she's a beautiful woman. She's well-dressed. And she said, and I'm afraid to move my hands off of the steering wheel. And I thought, gosh, what would I be like? I mean, you know, I can think of, I got pulled twice when I was like 18 and just flirted with a cop and got my way out of the tickets, you know, both times. The highway patrolman, the third one, he was not amused. So I got the ticket the third time, but yeah. It really struck me talking to her and, thinking about putting myself or trying to put myself in some small way into a position of living with that over your head, like the Damocles sword all the time. So I started to educate myself, and I appreciate the work that so many people in veterinary medicine have done, even though we're still obviously with some of the responses that are coming down the pipe, we have a ways to go. Definitely have a ways to go. Obviously, you know, the pandemic caused a lot of fear in people, and having your spleen removed and being an accident would really be fearful. But tell me about how you manage fear, because I think that is, you know, that's something really important that people with a lot of life experience seem to have managed the pandemic better than younger people just because they've been through a lot of stuff before.
Yeah, I think that for me, fear forces me to pray more, to turn inward more, to kind of reflect more on what's important to me. You know, I think sometimes fear is what you need to sometimes step into, you know, the next era and step into it with a sense of confidence. And I feel that that's truly been from me having time to really reflect and pray and figure out what's important to me. And that was literally how I got through the pandemic. It was a time to reset in the country. And I think for me, I needed to reset of how was I going to finish out my career? You know, what was really important to me, my family, obviously everybody turned to their family, like just they're important to me. What kind of legacy am I leaving for my children? You know, I don't know if they want to be veterinarians, but they know that their mom and their aunt and so many of their other aunties that are my friends, you know, are veterinarians. So to them, this is a very achievable career. And if they choose this career, what have I left for them? What is my legacy? And I started to realize that, yes, I could create impact on my patients' lives, but I couldn't, and I could change the hospital culture, but I wanted to do the things that you just mentioned. I wanted the face of our profession to look different, the culture mm-hmm. of our profession to look different. And I wanted it to be easier for people like me to see themselves in this role and know the next steps without having so much adversity and so many barriers. So that's really led to this. And that fear, I think, of just not being able to do those things is what pushed me. Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, this was there's safety in having a job as an entrepreneur. I know the leap that you take, because I started my business in 2008 in the middle of a recession. So, you know, maybe it was a wise
have to talk. Yeah, I'm gonna have to compare notes.
maybe it was a good idea. Maybe it wasn't. But it seemed to work out okay for me. How do you make these decisions? You sit here and you're thinking, okay, I want to do this work in the profession. I want it to have a face that finally looks like me. And, you know, as somebody, I will tell you, as a hiring manager, we talk a lot about, you know, this is the whitest profession, but I really feel like, I mean, I didn't have anybody apply. You know, that was one of my challenges, because there were no veterinarians of color. I've had I have a couple of clients who were Tuskegee grads who own practices nearby, and I've worked with them and they're both Black. Really out there into the world, if I look at all the applicants that have come over my desk in the 30 years that I've been interviewing veterinarians, people of color are few and far between. And so I'm glad that there are people who are showing that it is possible, you know, to be a veterinarian if you are a Latino, or if you are Black, or if you're, you know, Asian, any other people than white. It's also really good for business. And, you know, I always think about it as the business manager part of it, but I can remember the diversity of even of people who have handicaps, because our hospital was in a town that had a deaf school. And so we had a groomer who could sign. And when we had deaf clients come in, we always had her come up so that they were comfortable in having communication with her rather than us. I mean, we could communicate by writing down, but it was just having a plan and making people comfortable. And then when the other practice I managed, we had two ladies who were fluent in Spanish. And so when we would have non-English speakers come, we just got, you know, Rosa or Maria to come up and interpret for us, because we wanted people to have a good experience. It's really about good customer service too, is when you can not just make people form to your culture, but that you accommodate everybody's culture in your practice, because it's good business, it's good customer service, and it is thinking outside the box. So anyway, that's my little rant.
No, I mean, everything that you said is very, very true. The one thing that you said was, you know, the planning part, that's the key, the intentionality of it. And that was always very important to me, because even though I grew up in New York and there's so much diversity around, I was that child that had to translate to my grandparents. And sometimes we'd be in Sears and I'm trying to explain as an 8-year-old a washing machine. And so for me, being on the other side as a veterinarian, I cannot have children translating about serious disease processes, about euthanasia. Like, it's really hard. I think it's on us to look at how we, you know, reflect the communities that we serve, and whether it's how we hire and how we, you know, compensate those people that have skills that we don't have. And also just building a team where there is a plan in place when people of different, you know, backgrounds come in, that we are able to accommodate them. And I think that's step one to people feeling like they belong in this profession. And it doesn't matter, you know, if they're a client or an employee, like that same intentionality goes on both sides, mm-hmm. and people feel that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I've always wanted in this profession. It's not always what I've received. And so I'm really trying to, you know, outline what we can do that isn't very difficult. It's small wins that kind of create and change the culture mm-hmm. of our practices.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I'm in the middle of writing a book about hospitality and healthcare. And truly, this is what we're talking about. It's by being hospitable to everyone and having the plan in place. That's the anticipation of need, but also being observational and training yourself, because even different cultures, I can remember going to a museum and it was talking about the different cultures of personal space. And so mm-hmm. in like Saudi Arabia, those cultures, the personal space is close, and it would make us very uncomfortable as U.S. Citizens to have people right here. But then in Asian cultures, it's further back and it's about 5 feet. And so you have to understand that the even those little minor cultural differences are things that we need to accommodate as the service provider for people coming into our practices, or just people that we're working with or talking to or meeting, that we don't always put them into our box, that we have to understand. I remember reading Joe Navarro's book on body language, and he says that business executives in Arabic countries actually hold hands during business meetings. The men do. And I said, can you see a bunch of like IBM executives sitting around holding hands in the United States at a board meeting? It's just not going to happen. So you have to understand the culture that you're working with and make accommodations and be interested enough to care, right?
Yes. The curiosity part. I'm always asking my clients questions, you know, like even if they're like, I'm going away and I'm like, well, where are you going? Tell me more, you know, or if they're going home for the holidays, I'm always like, well, what's a good dessert that you like? Because it just makes people come alive when they're able to share a little bit about, and then you connect, and then you can have those stories. And that's, you know, a lot of, I do mentorship, and, you know, younger veterinarians will ask me, you know, where do you get this confidence? And I'm like, I certainly did not have it first out of school, but I started to realize that we're in a people business. Yeah. And if we connect with the clients, we can do anything with their pets, right? You know, but they have to trust us. They have to trust that we have their, you know, good intention in our heart, but for their pets. And once we've done that, the rest is, I mean, I loved general practice because I got to a point with so many of my clients where they'd be like, Dr. Bruno, we're here, whatever you want. That's golden. When you get to that level, that's golden.
Gosh, it is. I was teaching a class one day, and a veterinarian who used to be like our competitor down the road came up to me and he said, you know, Debbie, I used to wonder just what the hell you people did down there in your practice. Because every now and then for boarding over the holidays, he said, I'd get some of your overflow and they couldn't get in. And try as we might, and even though we were less expensive, we could not blast those people away from your practice. And he said, I always thought maybe it was the medicine or something magic. He said, but it was the hospitality and the connection. I went, that's it. That it really is it. And people learn, you know, we would see generations of pet owners. The children would grow up and then they would get married and they would come with their pets. And I worked in my first practice 19 years and was able to see multiple generations of pets, but also multiple generations of people. And that kind of trust and loyalty builds your business better than anything else you can do. I mean, you market yourself to the cows come home, but if you're not good to people when they're walking your door, it doesn't matter how much money you spend on your social media campaign.
Yes, that's for sure. I would always tell my staff, people will never forget how you made them feel. So if, you know, you're the first person in the hospital and you're the last person, so it doesn't even matter all the medicine that I know, you know, if they had a horrible experience on the way out, they're likely not coming back.
That's exactly right. They remember it all, everything. Yeah. So Nicole, what do you consider to be your biggest career mistake?
I think that a lot of times, when we talk about that fear before, I stayed longer than I should have. Mm-hmm. Like I knew that I was somewhere where it didn't serve me, but I was trying to find every excuse to stay because the next step seemed scarier to me. And so, you know, I think when you're in school, you kind of know, like, you're end of the road, like, you've graduated, you got to move on. Like, it's just, this is what happens. This is life. But when you're in a career, you know, it's a little different because you start to think about, well, I'm comfortable here, or I have great clients here. I love my colleagues here. But a lot of times we ignore that gut when feeling that we need to move on. And I think for me, when I look back on times in my career that I've pivoted, I should have probably pivoted sooner.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll agree with that too. I think I probably should have started my consulting business sooner than I did. But you know, sometimes you get pushed out of the nest and that's what happens. So what do you do? Right. You've got to say, okay, even if I got pushed out of the nest, I can't just sit here and wring my hands and stagnate. I've got to say, oh, here's an opportunity to do the thing I always wanted to do. So let me go for that. We can't not talk about Blend. So tell me, you know, how you came up with Blend. Tell us about it so we can share that message out there into the world. You know, what was it, about a year ago now that you started it?
A year ago to almost is when I took the leap, like where I was pushed out the nest, and I did it myself, but so that was about a year ago, but I came up with Blend, and we're trying to pivot to Blend Vet. So Blend Vet, I came up with it in 2020. And so it was literally, we had been a couple of months into the pandemic, but like I had said before, I've had this urge to do more in the DEI space. And with the pandemic, we couldn't really do much, but stay home and read and participate in podcasts. And so one of the things that I did was I took the Purdue Diversity and Inclusion Certificate, and I thought it was very much eye-opening for what I didn't even know that I didn't know, you know. Mm-hmm. And I realized then too, since I took it with a cohort of other veterinarians, how much it was helpful to have these conversations about, you know, DEI and just taking everybody's experiences. And I grew from that. And so I started doing more speaking events. And after doing a speaking event in for the Voice chapters and the VBMA chapters, I had so many students reach out to me saying that this was something that they needed in veterinary school, that they, you know, learned so much. And it made me sad, because one of the things that I've been very proud of is that my classmates and I started Voice, which is a student organization that still exists. And so in your mind, you're like, I created this organization that was supposed to make things better for you, you know, so you should be okay. Like, why are we still having these problems? And I started to think about, well, if they're having these problems in vet school, the world that they're going to enter into that I'm keenly aware of is no better. And I said, what's the solution here? And I started to think about the fact that, yes, DEI is a lot of terminology. It's a lot of, you know, things that you need to process and know and learn and grow. But the practicality of it, how do we bring that into our everyday clinical experience? How do we use that? And that's when I started to realize that we needed universal DEI training. We needed training that veterinary students had access to just as much as we had access to it, and that all of us in a hospital contribute to culture. It's not just me. It's the client service representatives. It's the kennel person that's bringing the pet up to the front to say goodbye to a client for going away for 2 weeks, right? All of that creates this culture. And because we were dealing in such a time where people were leaving the field in rapid rates, you know, hospitals were understaffed, burnt out. And so many of the people that I worked with, they wanted to stay. Like, we love vet med, but we were tired. Mm-hmm. And it was just so much at the same time. And I'm like, DEI is so, this is the heart of this, right? The wellness, the DEI, the culture, like all three of them is what creates better people, better places, and can kind of save our profession. So I just laid in the bed one night and I just thought about creating a veterinary hospital certification program in DEI. And I named it Blend. And I was trying to come up with this really cool acronym like we did with Voice, but I really started to think about what were the values for me that really could define culture and DEI and all those things in vet med. And I said, building relationships with people, how we lead and leading with vulnerability, the educational aspect, like wanting to continue to grow and you're not done. It's no, there's no confidence. We need to continue our humility pathway, right? The equity part of it, for sure. There's so much in our profession that we need to address. Navigating the unknown. So how do we have these tough conversations? And then diversity, inclusion, and belonging. And to me, all of these values together allow for hospitals, for workplaces to start to embrace inclusivity for all. And so that was like, that was my bright idea. And then I did nothing with it for a few months. You know, I didn't do anything. And then in 2021, I said, okay, let's pick this up again. Let's see what I can do. And, you know, the networking that the pandemic afforded, you know, allowed for Zoom meetings, mm-hmm. right? I'm not having to go to conferences to technically meet people or have, you know, you could actually just have a Zoom call with a CEO of a company and you're staying in his house, you know, or her house, right? So these were things that I thought were wonderful timing for me in the pandemic, was to meet the network and the team that now I continue to work with and who have helped to contribute to Blend, either through modules or connecting me to other people. I mean, it's been an amazing 2 years. But the last year was when I decided that I couldn't wear two hats and wear them well. I couldn't be a leader of a hospital and, you know, bring my vision to life. And I left. And it's a year this month, and actually in 10 days. And I'm proud of myself.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. It's, you know, it is something to look back on that first year and go, wow, it's already been a year. And then you kind of go and look what we did, right? That we look what we accomplished. And so I'm really, I'm tickled for you, because I know the work that is involved in this. And just in a few courses that I've created on communication, it's like, oh man, pushing a rope, it's hard. And then you have yours is much more broad. I mean, it really is so much. And, but I, you know, I think that your point about the pandemic being a time where we could, or those of us who were interested, who wanted to be better, could sit and learn. And, you know, all my life, I mean, I grew up in the South, and I grew up in the kitchen of a restaurant surrounded by Black people from the time I could, before I was born, quite honestly. And so I thought, you know, I really don't think I have very many biases. But then I started to read, you know, Dr. Kendi's book, and then I started to read White Fragility, and I started to study some more stuff. And I went, you know, I really probably still do. I mean, it's certainly not as great as some people that did not grow up like I grew up, or that had a mother who said, I don't care what color you are, you're a customer and money's great. That was my mother's attitude toward everything. It was, but I learned to catch myself and kind of, when something on autopilot kicks in your mind and you learn to stop and go, really? Does that make sense? You know, is that right? Is that just something, cultural bias that I grew up with? Or do I need to really rethink that? Because I like to study neuroscience, and I'm sure you do a lot too, because this is part of autopilot brain thinking, right? And yeah. So when we have these autopilot thoughts, then we need to recognize that they're an autopilot thought and go, wait a minute, that's not accurate. That's not an accurate thought. That's just something that is a stereotype, or it's something that I grew up around, or it's something, you know, you can even have biases like North and South, like New Yorkers are whatever, Southerners yes. are, right? Yeah.
I'm very keenly aware from that.
me too. But you know, I will tell you, the most fun I ever have speaking is when I come to New York, because people are so open and animated and opinionated and fun. And the one of the most challenging talks I ever gave was like in Wisconsin, where everybody is very quiet and taciturn. And they came up to her and said, this is the best talk I've ever heard. I went, I'm exhausted. I got no feedback. I'm worn out as a speaker. I put all this energy out and nobody said anything for 8 hours. I'm like, ah.
Yeah.
But it really is like, it's such a cultural thing wherever you are in the world. And it is amazing, when, especially when you start to travel a lot, that you see more than just race diversity, but it's a lot of different little nuances of how things play out in the world wherever you go. So I'm excited about Blend. I'm excited that it is, you know, it's a broader program than just, you know, ABC kind of stuff. And I love the fact that you understand too, that making connections with people, that's the key. You know, that is, that connectivity is the key to it. I've been preaching it a really, really long time. And I'm excited to see that people are going, well, yeah, that's the way we're supposed to do it. Oh my goodness. So let's talk about advice you would give somebody. You obviously had a really big life decision to make here, from leaving the safety of practice that you've been doing a long time, a great clientele. They trust you. It's probably almost plug and play with my life, right? Most of the work that you do. In fact, I was having a conversation with a couple of veterinary friends about medications, and they said, you know, I just reach for this because it's autopilot. This is, if you have this, I reach for that. And not really thinking about asking the question of the client, can you use this, right? How hard is it for you to use that? Tell me about the advice you would give somebody who's thinking about, you know, making a leap, or thinking about maybe being a disruptor in the world, because that's what, you know, that's what people do, you know, when they want to make change.
Well, I think that never ignore that gut feeling, never ignore your own feelings. I mean, like you said, I was plug and play. I could go into work and, you know, reach for medications and new doses in my head. And, you know, but it wasn't pushing me. It wasn't giving me that thrill anymore. It used to, you know, when you're learning the medicine, you're growing the teams. Those were things that I love to do. And I still love it. I mean, I still do relief. And when I go back in the clinics, I'm like, yeah, I still got it, or I still love this, you know. But the bigger things that were really weighing on my conscience and weighing on my spirit were doing more to change the way we look, the way our culture is. Mm-hmm. And for me, that I could not ignore that anymore. And so I think it's always best to have a plan. When I said I leaped, I did have a plan in place. I had already done some of the things, like to form the LLC, to really have had the network at that point where I felt more comfortable. So I can't say that tomorrow, if you have this great idea, that you should just leap and quit your job. You know, I think the plan has to be in place, and I've always been a planner. And I guess when I said before, like, I stayed longer than I should have, and maybe sometimes I stayed longer because the plan still had to, I still had to cross my T's and dot my I's a little bit better. But, you know, I'm living on faith right now. You know, it is, being an entrepreneur is very challenge, has its challenges, but there's a sense of freedom that I have to be able to have conversations like this, to be able to pursue what I really, really want. And I think that if you are feeling like that's the way you're heading, then you should start planning now, because, you know, there's value in the plan for that. So that's the best advice. And just even realizing too, and what I've learned, is that what you think is the plan, you got to make sure that you know the art of pivoting, because it's probably not going to go as you thought it was. So have multiple plans in place. And, you know, and I think that as veterinarians, we're used to that, because we walk into rooms and we got at least three options, you know, hopefully, to offer a client. And depending on which way they go, the plan pivots, you know. And so I think using that mindset and leaning on what we're good at and multitasking can help you too in this world.
You know, I've always thought that veterinarians should be particularly good at this kind of stuff, and even figuring out the communication styles of people, because they're diagnosticians. They're taught to parse out these things that, you know, clients are telling you bits and pieces, and you're just observing this animal and trying to figure out, you know, what's wrong with the patient who can't speak with you. They should be so good, once they're taught this kind of stuff, to be able to figure out the humans in their world and to be able to move forward and make those pivots, because that's just trained up here in this brilliant brain. And we all know that, I've always told my clients, the veterinarians are some of the smartest people that walk the earth, and they're smarter than your human doctors. And people go, what? The human.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, I think that kind of like what we were talking about earlier, it's like we fall on what we're used to. We reach for the old, you know, medication that we're normal. And so when we're in rooms with clients, like, as soon as we start hearing them say what triggers, like, oh, this is probably this kind of case, like, our mind's already gone there and we're no longer listening. And I think that that's the biggest thing about the connection part. We lose that ability to bond. So it is being very much, I sometimes say an actress, you know, like you're playing all the roles in a room, but really the connecting part is, I've had to learn, like, I just need to write up my records afterwards. I need to spend these 10, 15 minutes connecting. And, you know, that has helped me get through some appointments that could have gone differently, right? If the foundation of a relationship wasn't there. So, you know, it's the things that you learn, but this is a really great profession. And I think that the one thing that I want is, you know, the children to want to see it and hold on to what makes it great all the way through the pipeline, you know, and that's why within the last few months, you know, Blend has really been trying to kind of create that opportunity for students to be able to do that and have that support.
So, yeah. Tell us about that a little bit, because you at VMX, I saw that, and I think Walter Brown.
Yes.
Something to do with it too. And
yes.
And so tell us a little bit about what you're doing with the children.
Yeah. So last year, so 2022 VMX, it was one of the first times I was stepping into the speaker circuit. And I sat there and I was like, you know, VMX is always on MLK weekend. And to me, I always did community service on MLK Day. It's always a day on, not a day off for me. And so I realized that I was always going to be in Orlando. I was always going to be away from my children unless I brought them, you know, and I thought of the fact that because we were in Orlando was an opportunity to connect with the community and to actually offer an opportunity for students to come and see Vet Med in the flesh. Not, I go to and do a lot of career days, but I'm going to the school with all my stuff, but there's value of bringing them into us. And I'm very fortunate to have a network of colleagues from all sorts of veterinary schools and backgrounds, but, you know, especially having Tuskegee and Cornell at my fingertips could allow me to create a panel of faculty that, you know, come from all different specialties and walks of life to really try to show students that you don't have to, you know, go to general practice, and you may take your dog with you to the vet and see that role as a veterinarian, but there's so many other things you can do in our profession. And so leaning on, you know, my sister who does forensics, and, you know, my best friend Joya, who's dermatologist, and Walter, you know, because I think it's important for students to see that there's other roles in veterinary medicine, you know, and that, and he's such a dynamic technician and has done so much to really try to be that bridge, you know, to really allow veterinarians to see the value. And I mean, for me, vet technicians have always been my right hand. Like I tell them all the time, I can't do this without you. Like, I don't want to do this without you.
Yes.
But the fact that he is willing to be vulnerable and share his stories, and as a Black man, which is more of a unicorn in vet med, I thought he was perfect to add on. And then Courtney Campbell as a surgeon. I mean, you know, we were the unicorns of vet med. And so I wanted students to see it. And we did target underrepresented students, but we opened it up because at the end of the day, we need to increase the pipeline regardless. I just as much as my first exposures have been of white veterinarians, what there's nothing wrong with, you know, having us as your first eye-opening experience into vet med. And so we had students of all backgrounds ultimately that came to the event, and the conversations that we had a parent room. So my mom flew down and we talked to the parents about the support and the role that they play in supporting their students through the pipeline. My sister spoke about her pathway and how we differed in our careers. And then we had a workshop where they rotated through stations and learned about the different options that the specialties offer. And then we gave them some next steps, because a lot of times at this age, you know, students can't go work at a veterinary hospital due to liability. And so I wanted to show them opportunities through programs like Vets That Go, or the, you know, camps that exist in veterinary colleges, that they can do that as a next step. And so it was just such a great, rewarding experience, you know, to have planned it from the start to the finish line. And, you know, the students were excited. They're ready to come back next year. We're ready. Now we've learned on what we need to do and what we can improve. But this to me was, you know, my way of giving back and what I would have always wanted to have had as a 12-year-old that I didn't have. And so if I can do it better now, then that's what we're going to continue to do.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, you know, think about Dr. Charisse Roth's book and the fact that it's a role model thing, right? You've got to see people who look like you, who are doing what you're doing. And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, I was one of those kids who wanted to be a veterinarian, but when I was going to apply to vet school, women were rare in veterinary medicine. Yes. And so now we've had this huge sea change where women are, you know, 87% of our profession, just about, and the men are the rarity. But a lot of those things change. And then even as a manager, when I was a new manager, there were very few practice managers who weren't men, and very few practice managers who weren't practice owners. So it was, you know, there's another pathway there. I've done some work at NC State with the pre-vet students and said, look, this was my path. I have an animal science degree and I decided I didn't want to go to vet school, but I've always been in the profession and loved what I do. And if you think about building culture, managers have a huge role in playing who gets hired and building those cultures and making sure that we're, you know, building a team that is respectful of everyone. And we need to train managers too. That's another.
And that is why it was so important to me for Blend to be that universal training. But, you know, to your point, it's like when we go to even high school, that's why I said this, those pipeline issues, because counselors, our guidance counselors, prepared to how to, you know, support a child to say, I want to be a vet, or I just want to be in the animal industry. What are my opportunities? What do I need to do? And that's not something that is universally theirs, so unless we show up, unless we go to schools, unless we, you know, I'm convinced that one day I'm going to have this like manual that I hand to every counselor, like, you want to be a tech, you want to be a manager. Because to your point, when I was in my first animal science 101 at Tuskegee, he was my academic advisor, but a professor of that class, he said, not all of you are going to vet school. Mm-hmm.
No.
So, and we all looked at each other and was like, what? Like, yeah, just, right. You know,
but I will. But, right. Yeah.
Yeah. I certainly am going to be a vet. That's why I'm here. But he was like, not all of you are going to be vets, but there are amazing careers in the animal industry. Mm-hmm. So we're going to learn about this in 101. And he was right. I have friends that we got our BS together, but they are doing completely different things, but in the animal sector. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. There's value in all of that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was, I asked Dr. Shweta Trivedi, is the counselor for the pre-vet program. And I said, how many of these students do you have who are in pre-vet? And she said, right, like there's, you know, 900, 1,000 of them in the whole curriculum. And I said, how many of them will get in vet school? And the answer is 80, you know, out of all those students. And the 20 of those have to go out of state, and because they have to accept 20 out of state students there. I said, so what are you doing for all the other ones? Because they don't even know that there are these different career paths. They think, well, if I want to work with animals, I have to be a veterinarian. But, you know, I've loved every minute of being in the periphery of the medicine, because I do love the science of it. It is so cool for me. But I love the people part of it too, and the business management. And, you know, it is, for me, it was like I was the puzzle master. I put the pieces together to have the whole picture of the puzzle. And that's what I loved about it. So there are different things that people can do and still be in the profession. And we need them all. We really need them all. You're exactly right. All right. Let's talk about a fun fact about you. Do you have a secret talent, a favorite song, something people would be surprised to know about you?
Well, I was an actress. I did some acting when I was younger. And my first movie was in 1984. It was called Turk 182. And I was a little girl that fell out of a burning building with Robert Urich.
Oh, my goodness. So I had
Robert Urich, Timothy Hutton, and Kim Cattrall, which people know Kim Cattrall from Sex and the City. But that was my first big movie. And I remember, for a while, I would get, because I was part of the Screen Actors Guild, so I would get little checks if the movie came on the air, and it'd be like literally 96 cents. Oh, but to me, it was like, you know, so I would always be like, Mom, I should have been on the Cosby Show or something, or, you know, but it was fun. But it was hard when you're like having to choose what you want to do in life. And I didn't see acting as my passion. And so it was hard to go to auditions in New York and not be guaranteed a job. Mm-hmm. So I would lose school. And so it wasn't something that I I stuck with, but my mom is never afraid to pull out all of my movies and videos and show people what I've done. So,
well, now I didn't realize that we were going to have a list of credits that we needed to put on the end of this. Don't, so you can go and look at
your movies. You don't have to.
But you know what?
It was literally like the first 10 minutes. You blink and you miss me.
That's, hey, I think my only TV appearance was one time I was managing the hospital and I went on about, you know, making sure your dogs were inside for the cold. And somebody called me one day and said, what am I supposed to do about this dog? And I was giving advice over on the TV show. And I had also started a fundraiser with kind of a combination of art show and friends of animals, and had pulled together a whole bunch of artists to donate part of their proceeds from their sales to the Friends of Animal Foundation. And I was on TV. That, and 100 years ago, it was on the old Rebel show. It was like a children's show, like Captain Kangaroo, but it was local. Did that. All right. Well, any final words of wisdom, anything you'd like to say, you know, in information about Blend, how can people find that?
So yes, for certain, if you want to check out our website, www.blend.vet, V-E-T, you know, we are constantly posting where we're going to be, what conferences we're going to attend. We will also be doing live trainings, but we're getting ready to launch our hospital certification program with Rare Breed. And we have been doing some work with Lincoln Memorial University, so in the academic spectrum as well. So I'm excited about that work. But our pipeline development, I thought that VMX was basically like just an opportunity for me to do this and potentially do it yearly. But so many organizations have reached out to me wanting to do a pipeline program like what we did at VMX. So if you're interested in, you know, volunteering, you can always send me an email or contact me through the website. And that way I can follow up with you on when our next pipeline events are and how you can volunteer, especially when they're at conferences. It's a little easy. Yeah.
That's amazing. I love those pipeline events. We are going to be so shorthanded of veterinarians and veterinary technicians in the next 10 years that you guys are actually doing something about it by feeding this pipeline of students into the colleges so that we will be graduating them, not soon enough, but at least, you know, when we need them. Definitely.
And we will give them the support and the mentorship and the guidance and the things that, you know, we've needed. And so that's my hope is that when we do bring the students that we're investing in now, it's an investment. Mm-hmm. It's that intentionality. It's the plan. We do that now, then we will have colleagues that are a little bit more supported as they're navigating all of the nuances that we know, you know, are there for them. So mm-hmm. I'm excited and hopeful and, you know, Michelle Obama, I read her book recently, and I wrote it as the only quote so far in my passion planner. And she wrote, "The unknown is where possibility glitters." And so, you know, we don't know, but there's so much possibility.
There is possibility. You just got to keep looking for it. That's just, and keep making it happen because you're making it happen too.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for following up with me so that you got a new business card.
That's right. I have it right here in my desk, but I now know how to find you all the time. Perfect. Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bruno. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Bend. We'll put all of Dr. Bruno's information in the show notes and how to contact her and to directly over to blend.vet so you can get training for your team and certification for your hospital. And we look forward to having you join us again on the next episode of The Bend. I'm your host, Debbie Boone.